Hello everyone, and welcome back to Family for Every Child's Conversation on Care podcast. My name is Amanda Griffith, and I'm the CEO of Family for Every Child. Family for Every Child is a growing network of currently 41 local civil society organisations working on the ground in 37 countries. And these organisations have an absolute wealth of knowledge and experience from years of working with children and communities to develop solutions to improve children's care. Today's podcast focuses upon a topic which is high priority for our alliance, and that is kinship care. Kinship care, that is the care of children by relatives or friends of the family, represents a significant resource available for meeting the needs of girls and boys who are orphaned or otherwise living apart from their parents. 1 in 10 children worldwide are living in kinship care in some countries. It's even higher, as much as 1 in 3. This makes it the most common type of care after parental care. At Family for Every Child, we believe that kinship care needs increased recognition and support and needs to be the first care option for children outside of parental care. So today I'm really delighted to talk to Blessing Muntama, who is the Director of Farm Orphans Support Trust, known as FOST, based in Harare in Zimbabwe. FOST has been an active member of our alliance since 2015, and Blessing, one of our board members. Since 1997, FOST has been supporting vulnerable children in Zimbabwe, particularly in farm worker communities. Zimbabwe faces multiple challenges that affect the capacity of families and communities to protect and care for children. The country is home to around 1.5 million orphaned and vulnerable children, and about 1 in every 4 has lost one or both of their parents, the majority because of HIV and AIDS. So in this really challenging environment, FOST enables community-based protection systems in remote areas and works to ensure that children can grow up with their siblings in a familial environment. They run the Supporting Orphan and Vulnerable Children Programme, known as SOVC, and kinship care is a core component of this work. Bless and welcome, and thank you for joining me today. I'm excited to learn more from you about your work.
Thank you very much, Amanda, for allowing me to be part of this, and I'm quite honoured. Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure. So, Blessing, I think to start off with, it would be really helpful to give people the context in which you're working. So to understand really more about Zimbabwe, it's a bit more about its history in terms of the socio-political patterns, as well as we know that you face really some challenging natural disasters as well. And to really understand how that impacts on the communities that you work with, which are these farming communities and children.
Maybe just to start with, to say the organization was established in 1997. Basically, we were responding to the increasing needs during then of orphaned and vulnerable children. And this was mainly as a result of HIV and AIDS. During the 90s, you'd realize that HIV was actually in its peak, and AIDS was claiming so many lives of people because during that time, we didn't have any medication or any treatment for the virus. So this led to a steep increase on the number of orphans and vulnerable children on a daily basis, resulting in an increase on the number of children who are actually needing care. So we saw a big number of children needing care in terms of kinship care, and some of the children who could not be placed in kinship care to be placed in other models of care, such as institutions and foster care, and a few of them were actually adopted. But you'd realize that the prevalent of them all during that time and even up until now was kinship care. Children continue, you know, to be placed into kinship care. And I think one of the reasons is that traditionally, you know, in our culture, when a child is born, the child is not born for the immediate family alone, but you'd realize that the child is born for the whole community. This philosophy actually helps us to nurture what we call community parenting for children within our communities. Hence, what I'm saying is that a child belongs to all the people in the community. So as a result of the demand for care, as it was increasing, you'd realize that the community safety nets for these children then became overwhelmed, you know, because you see families were now beginning to absorb many children. Let's say a family of five who end up having 10 children. And in terms of now providing adequate care for those children, it became difficult for those children. Hence, there was that weakening of the child community safety nets. Then we also saw a higher number of children needing placement into other families. And we have seen this, some families taking in children from their relatives. And like I've highlighted that as the number increased, this affected, you know, their ability to cope, you know, with providing care for the children. Then also in terms of stigma also came out, you know, very strongly due to HIV and AIDS. And you'd realize that in terms of kinship care, we had some effects, you know, where we had some families not accepting, you know, children from maybe it's a brother that have died, and because of stigma, they could not, you know, take the child from the brother because the brother had died of HIV or the mother had died of HIV and AIDS. Then as a country, you would also realize that we over the years, we have experienced, you know, a mirage of natural and man-made disasters. And actually, this includes disasters such as the cyclones. We also have the drought, and just recently we have the COVID that is still affecting the country. So with cyclone, you'd realize that in March 2019, particularly in three of our districts, many families they lost their loved ones, livelihoods, and belongings. And as a result, you know, there was psychological trauma associated with both loss of loved ones and dramatic changes, you know, in a way of life. You know, maybe a child who used to get some sort of support from the family could no longer get that that kind of support, which changed the way of life for the children. More importantly, you'd realize that lack of closure became traumatic as most of their loved ones were swept away and never found, formally buried. Some of the children went through a delayed mourning as they were busy focusing on their survival during the, you know, the immediate aftermath of the cyclone, coupled with a number of shocks. And we also realized that there was also delayed grieving for these children and even their caregivers. Emotional wounds really, you know, may be less visible than the destruction of the homes that actually were done by cyclone. But it often takes far longer to recover from emotional impact than to overcome material losses. And one of the things as a result of the cyclone, you'd realize that they went through, they experienced heavy winds and floods, destruction of infrastructure like schools, churches, you know, which meant that children could no longer access a safe space where they could play with their peers. This actually significantly affected their cognitive development and relationship building skills, which actually led us to the need of creating some safe spaces for these children within the communities so that we could enhance their psychosocial development and peer-to-peer emotional support. Then, in terms of drought, maybe looking at drought, you'd realize that a drought-induced vulnerability, you know, correlated with protection violations like transactional sex, actually came into play, you know, and is still coming into play because of the drought that we are experiencing in Zimbabwe. The current dry spell that we have seen has actually seen many families suffering, especially in the rural areas of Zimbabwe and the farming communities of Zimbabwe. Women and children, you know, are especially vulnerable to the effects of drought as livelihoods are lost. And usually it becomes increasingly difficult, you know, to secure a decent meal for the family. there are many women-led households and children-headed families that rely on subsistence farming and livestock rearing. These two groups have actually devalued, you know, their nutritional statuses. For children, going to school on an empty stomach, it actually had negative effects on their schooling performance and cognitive development. Then also coming to COVID, the prevailing economic stress further increased by the impact of COVID-19 lockdown, you know, on those families that were actually dependent on informal economy for their survival has actually affected them, because you find that most of the families that we are supporting, particularly as forced in the farming communities, they rely on informal trading. And the lockdown actually did not allow, you know, informal trading. So this really affected these families in terms of their survival. Then also issues around anxiety as a result of the outbreak, and living in the lockdown without access to basic services has massively increased stress in these households. Nationally, you know, we have noted psychosocial distress, anxiety, and depression in children and caregivers, which has actually increased and has resulted in increased risk of sexual and other forms of violence and abuse on children and their families. Yeah.
Thanks, Blessing. So what you're describing is really over many years, a sort of cycles of vulnerability building each on each other to really end up in a situation where some families are in a very precarious setting. Because as you say, it's the external environment that's leading to then sort of the impact, both at an individual level in terms of the psychological impact, as you say, those emotional wounds and that are invisible that take a long time to mend, but also then around the child and the families, that those community protection systems have been disrupted and weakened, and then how the knock-on then is as school, that the impact on lack of schooling and lack of protection leads to things like malnutrition, poorer education, and that on top of all of that sort of cyclical downward challenges that families are facing is now finally this layer of COVID, which is putting additional stresses on it. Yes. So I was wondering, Blessing, in terms of that incredibly complex environment of vulnerabilities and risks, what is it that you're actually focusing in on through your supporting orphan and vulnerable children program? What are the different strands that you're taking forward to address this complex environment?
Right. So in our model, the SOV model, you'd realize that we kind of have about three pillars that we are looking at, that we are focusing on. The first one being family and community strengthening, where we believe, like, you know, when you're talking about kinship care as an organization, you know, we've been supporting kinship care since our inception. We believe that if we are able to strengthen the family and prevent separation, you know, children will be cared for and better protected, you know, within their families and within their communities. So we actually implementing some activities that focus on family strengthening and prevention of separation of children. Then we are also working on issues to do with household economic strengthening. Because we are saying, when we look at issues around care for children, we want to build the capacity of the family to be able to care for their own children. You know, it's not sustainable for families to be getting handouts now and again from organizations such as us. We want them to have that capacity to be able to have a garden, you know, a low input garden where they can have their vegetables. They don't have to buy vegetables for the children. A small garden where they can plant their own millimeal. You know, at the end of the year, they harvest and they have millimeal for the children. So we are also working on activities that strengthen those households along issues to do with the household economic situation. Then we are also focusing on building resilience of the households around issues to do with psychosocial strengthening. You'd realize, like, most of the households, the children who are being supported by kinship care, they are staying with grandmothers. You know, this brings in a lot of issues around parenting because of the generational gaps. So you find in our programming, we try to address those issues, you know, psychosocial, you know, issues within those families. So we do support some support groups for grandmothers, support groups for women, support groups for children, where they can access a psychosocial support, you know, within those groups. Then the second pillar actually focuses on youth capacity building, where we are saying these children, you know, irregardless of their vulnerability, you know, they are the leaders for tomorrow. Some they say they are even the leaders for today. So we need to catch them young. So in this project, we are working with children and young people, and we are focusing on issues to do with sexual and reproductive health and rights, because we want them to know their rights, you know, to health, their rights to reproductive health, their rights to sexual health. So we have what we call kids clubs that we are supporting. And basically kids clubs, these are spaces, you know, where children can meet and provide each other with peer-to-peer support and any other information, you know, that relates to their development. Because we want them to have that opportunity for full development, you know, in terms of their potential. What potential that does each child have? What support can each child be given so that they can develop to their full potential? Then under this pillar, we also look at empowering, you know, the children and the youths. So you'd realize that these clubs, they are not run by adults, but they actually run by the young people themselves. So through that, you know, we are empowering them, you know, to run their own things, to run their own activities, projects that they'll be running within those clubs. Then the last pillar focuses on child protection, which is our main pillar, which focuses on child protection and child rights. And under this pillar, we are looking at all the rights, you know, enshrined in the UNCRC, because we are saying we want each and every child, regardless of their vulnerability, regardless that they are coming from the farming communities, you know, the most vulnerable communities, but, you know, they need to be assisted to achieve or to access, you know, their rights in terms of protection. So under that pillar, you know, we do a lot of advocacy work, you know, advocating like with the registrar to ensure you find the areas that we are working in the farming communities, because these people, they are coming from surrounding countries, and usually they come through the informal borders, not the formal borders. So I find in terms of documentation, they don't have proper documentation, which makes it a challenge for them to have things like birth certificates, you know, the identity cards for themselves, which even makes it worse, because if you don't have an identification card, it's difficult for you to get an identification card for your child as well. So you find that most of the children within these communities, you know, they have got issues with accessing, you know, their identities. So we do a lot of advocacy with the registrar so that they could assist these families so that the children can get birth certificates. Then if you look at the structure of the farming communities, you'd realize that they were owned, the owner of the farm was the responsible authority, not the government. So the responsible authority was responsible for whatever happens, you know, within those communities. So talk of things like schooling, building schools, you know, the farmer had to build his or her own farm so that the children for his workers would access schools. So you find there were a lot of issues around children within the farming communities accessing education. One, because the schools, you know, there were very few schools, you know, within the farming communities. So we had to do a lot of advocacy with the government so that they could also, you know, build schools in the near catchment areas of those farming areas. And also in terms of education assistance for the children, the farm workers, if you look at the amount of salaries that they get, you're looking at someone earning somewhere around $20 a month. And that same person would then want to feed the family with that same amount. So you find they would then have to prioritize, you know, education or food for the children. Mm-hmm. So in most cases, education for them becomes a secondary priority. So we would then have to come in, you know, to support, you know, most of the vulnerable children so that with paying for the school fees, buying them things like uniforms so that they are able to access education and other basic services. Then we also carry out awareness you know, particularly during the HIV era, you know, we had to do a lot of awareness in the farming communities because people were really dying in high numbers. So we had to do a lot of awareness, you know, and mostly it was because of their behaviors. These people are coming from different countries, they've got different cultures, you know, it even made it worse. So we had to come in with awareness so that they would understand what HIV is and try to make sure that they access, you know, treatment when we started having ARVs, you know, within the country. So these are the three pillars that we have focused on, although we do have other cross-cutting issues, you know, that are actually mainstreamed within those pillars in the SOV model.
That's brilliant. Thank you, Blessing. It's really comprehensive. And what I'm hearing is that all three of those pillars, what runs through that is a real clear commitment to addressing rights violations, but also about agency and about resilience and about autonomy and things. So it's very much driven by a perspective that you are from working from a basis of strength, even with those in the most precarious and vulnerable settings, is tapping into their strengths and then working on things like not just direct services, but enabling them to develop for themselves the skills and the wherewithal and the economic strengthening to be able to direct their own lives. And also, I think alongside that, what I'm hearing is that you're also doing knowledge, attitudes and behaviour change, particularly through advocacy, but then also advocacy for wider policies change. So it's a very well-integrated approach, but one that's also very much based on strengths and rights and looking at the different spheres within the community of the wider family, but then also looking at the young leaders themselves and then the community response, which is that wider child protection. So different spheres of that you're influencing within that community. Does that kind of reflect what you think is the situation that you're doing?
Yes, okay. You have correctly summarized it. Oh, yeah, sure.
So, and out of all of that, because I mean, I don't want to unpick what is obviously a very holistic and comprehensive approach, but what's your sense of the group that, particularly speaking about those sort of cycles of vulnerability you explained earlier about the years of these, that this precarious community has been going through increasingly complex environment. In terms of that, what do you think is the most impactful for those kinship carers? And I'm guessing predominantly those are grandmothers. So what do you think is the thing that's actually managing in terms of support and interventions that is the most impactful for them?
Right. So you'd realize that already kinship care itself is already deeply rooted, you know, within our tradition as a nation, because you'd realize that it carries some obligation, you know, to provide care and support for your brother's child or your sister's child. But you would realize that we have seen that there are gaps that are presenting. That are affecting the impact of this model of care, you know, within our country. As an organization with support from Family for Every Child, you know, we were able to carry out a scoping study on kinship care, which really tried to establish whether kinship care is still thriving within the country. If not, you know, what are the reasons why it's not thriving? So it brings out issues, you know, related to the question that you have just asked. So one of the things that we have realized is that as a country, in terms of, there's a big gap in terms of supporting, you know, the model, you know, from the government. Because kinship care is taken as a traditional practice, you'd realize placement of children is done, you know, by their relatives. You know, when a mother dies, the relatives, they just sit down after burial and agree that this child will be taken care by so and so, maybe that could be a sister or a grandmother. And basically they look at issues of capacity to care financially. That's what they normally look who within the family has got best finances, you see. But they don't look at other risks in terms of child protection for that child. Mm-hmm. So that child is simply moved to that household. And we've had so many cases of children, you know, who were then abused when they were placed in the household. So in terms of assessment, sorry, not support, there is a real need, you know, for assessment of placement of children. Then also, you know, after assessment, there is lacking is the component of monitoring. You know, those children, they then need to be monitored, you know, in those households that they've been placed, whether they are receiving adequate care. Yes, they are staying with the relative, but is the relative providing the adequate care that we expected the relative to provide? You know, what are the challenges that the relative is facing, so that if there is need for support, we know the kind of support that we need to come in with. So this is another area that came out that our government needs to strengthen. Then also in terms of support, I think with other models, like in Zimbabwe, we also have a foster care model, which receives some better support from the government, although it's not much, but at least you'd recognize that there's some form of support that is going towards that model, where they are given a grant, you know, for taking care of those children. And with the grant, you can buy meal, you can buy household needs generally with that grant. But with kinship care, you know, there is nothing of that sort. So these are the three things that we are trying to push, you know, currently in our advocacy as an organization, so that the government would recognize this. And we are actually currently in a process, because we then wanted to develop some guidelines on kinship care, because we felt that if we have guidelines on kinship care, that would increase or improve, you know, the impact of kinship care on the children and the families who are practicing this model. But we then realized that as a country, our policy, because the guidelines, you know, they should speak to the policy that is there, you know, with regards to the children. So in Zimbabwe, in terms of our policy, it was actually developed in 1997, and since then, the policy was not reviewed. The Zimbabwe National Orphan Care Policy, it was not reviewed. So I find there were a lot of gaps that were within the policy. So we agreed, after advocacy and lobbying in with the government, because what we did is we then came together with other local organizations such as SOS and ZNCWC, and we then started to push, you know, for the government to review this policy, so that when they review this policy, we'll then be able to develop the guidelines for kinship care or alternative care, you know, in broad. So currently we are actually, the government agreed that the policy needs to be reviewed, and with support from Family for Every Child, you know, we've been able to facilitate some meetings, and the policy is currently now being reviewed. It's almost in its final stages. So after the review of this policy, we are looking forward to develop the guidelines, which we believe would then help improve the practice of kinship care within our country, Zimbabwe.
So if I summarize that to what I'm hearing then, Blessing, is that you've started by recognizing what's already a strong tradition that exists within Zimbabwe communities, and that is the capacity of the community to actually take on responsibility for children when there's the loss of the parents, and that they have a whole process in place for ensuring that that child is taken care of within the community. So that's a pre-existing tradition that happens within the community. But as you say, that what's come through from research, and the importance of research to give you insights into this, is that actually that's not necessarily always a caring and protective environment. And that if one only looks at the economic situation, you lose sight of the importance of the emotional and psychological support that also needs to be in place, particularly for maybe grandparents who are particularly vulnerable in terms of economically, they're struggling anyway, and there's the generational distances and things. So ensuring that that there's support around that. But as you importantly say, is that there also needs to be, within the formal system, at least there needs to be legislation that supports and recognises the importance of kinship care, both in terms of supporting those kinship carers to be able to provide that protective environment, but also taking responsibility for assessment and monitoring so that we can ensure that those environments are always safe for children. And that needs not just policy and legislation change that you're working on at the moment, but then in your future, what you're thinking of is, and then that needs guidelines for practice so that the policy is implemented in terms of those two sides of support to kinship carers and also assessment and monitoring of children within kinship care. So it's quite, again, a very sort of comprehensive sense of build on the existing strengths, but then enhancing them through national legislation and then through guiding practice.
Yeah.
That's... So Blessing, I think that's been, unless there's something you wanted to add to that, I think what you've really shared with us is some fantastically rich perspectives of, first of all, the Zimbabwe context of these sort of cycles of vulnerability that have been experienced by the most marginalized communities, because these farming communities are most marginalized. And as you say, not even under the jurisdiction of the government necessarily, but under the jurisdiction of private farm holders, and how the experience of HIV and AIDS and then various natural disasters and now COVID have really made their context very vulnerable. But you've, as a consequence, come up with a very comprehensive program, this SOVC program, which looks at your three pillars that from a strength base of really building agency and from a rights perspective, but then not only looking at what you're supporting and enabling through that program, but also being cognizant of the importance of saying that you've really got to work with communities, work with their traditions, and then overlay that with national legislation, and that national legislation must be implemented through guidelines for practitioners. Blessing, that fantastically thoughtful, very comprehensive, I hope has really helped other people to really think about what does one do when working in a complex environment to really pull together something that means that it's very holistic, as you've described. So I think our time together is nearly up now. And so I just want to thank you very much, Blessing, for this fascinating conversation. And thank those who have joined us and are listening to this Conversation in Care's podcast. Families Kinship Care campaign runs between March and June this year, 2021. And through the campaign, we've been sharing the work we've done on kinship care, which Blessing has referred to in terms of this research and developing guidelines, raising aware of those really key benefits that we know kinship care can provide, but also not losing sight of the challenges and needs of those kinship care families. And how, as Blessing's described, we're also calling on governments to invest in kinship care research, to prioritise kinship care in decision making about children's care and providing support to those kinship care families, but always ensuring that there's also that assessment and monitoring in place. So I think on that basis, you can help us spread the word and engage further in our conversation and activities around kinship care and other key issues around family strengthening by joining our community on the Changemakers for Children community platform. And please do visit changemakersforchildren.community to register and be a part of our movement for change. The more users there are, the stronger we will be. We hope you will join us next time. Thank you for listening and goodbye.